She's tucked her red-gloved hands up into her sleeves to hide them. The interpreter turns back to the group, chatters at them in staccato. I know what he'll be saying, I know the line. He'll be telling them that the women here have different customs, that to stare at them through the lens of a camera is, for them, an experience of violation. I'm looking down at the sidewalk, mesmerized by the women's feet. One of them is wearing open-toed sandals, the toenails painted pink. I remember the smell of nail polish, the way it wrinkled if you put the second coat on too soon, the satiny brushing of sheer pantyhose against the skin, the way the toes felt, pushed towards the opening in the shoe by the whole weight of the body. The woman with the painted toes shifts from one foot to the other. I can feel her shoes on my own feet. The smell of nail polish has made me hungry. Excuse me, says the interpreter again to catch our attention. I nod to show I've heard him. He asks, are you happy? Says the interpreter. I can imagine it, their curiosity. Are they happy? How can they be happy? I can feel their bright black eyes on us, the way they lean a little forward to catch our answers, the women especially, but the men too. We are secret, forbidden. We excite them. Evglenn says nothing. There is a silence. But sometimes it's as dangerous not to speak. Yes, we are very happy, I murmur. I have to say something. What else can I say? Chapter 6. A block past All Flesh, Evglenn pauses, as if hesitant about which way to go. We have a choice. We could go straight back, or we could walk the long way around. We already know which way we will take, because we always take it. I'd like to pass by the church, says Evglenn, as if piously. All right, I say, though I know as well as she does what she's really after. We walk sedately. The sun is out. In the sky there are white fluffy clouds, the kind that look like headless sheep. Given our wings, our blinkers, it's hard to look up, hard to get the full view of the sky, of anything. But we can do it, a little at a time. A quick move of the head, up and down, to the side and back. We have learned to see the world in gasps. To the right, if you could walk along, there's a street that would take you down towards the river. There's a boathouse where they kept the skulls once, and some bridges, trees, green banks, where you could sit and watch the water, and the young men with their naked arms, their oars lifting into the sunlight as they played at winning. On the way to the river are the old dormitories, used for something else now, with their fairy tale turrets painted white and gold and blue. When we think of the past, it's the beautiful things we pick out. We want to believe it was all like that. The football stadium is that way, too, where they hold the men's salvagings, as well as the football games. They still have those. I don't go to the river anymore, or over bridges, or on the subway, although there's a station right there. We're not allowed on. There are guardians now. There's no official reason for us to go down those steps, ride on the trains under the river into the main city. Why would we want to go from here to there? We would be up to no good, and they would know it. The church is a small one of the first erected here, hundreds of years ago. It isn't used anymore, except as a museum. Inside it you can see paintings of women in long, somber dresses, their hair covered by white caps, and of upright men, darkly clothed and unsmiling. Our ancestors. Admission is free. We don't go in, though, but stand on the path, looking at the churchyard. The old gravestones are still there, weathered, eroding with their skulls and crossed bones. Memento mori. Their dough-faced angels, their winged hourglasses to remind us of the passing of mortal time, and from a later century, their urns and willow trees for mourning. They haven't fiddled with the gravestones or the church either. It's only the more recent history that offends them. Evglenn's head is bowed, as if she's praying. She does this every time. Maybe I think there's someone, Someone in particular gone for her, too. A man, a child. But I can't entirely believe it. I think of her as a woman for whom every act is done for show, is acting rather than a real act. She does such things to look good, I think. She's out to make the best of it. But that is what I must look like to her as well. How can it be otherwise? Now we turn our backs on the church, and there is the thing we've in truth come to see. The wall. The wall is hundreds of years old, too, or over 100 at least. Like the sidewalks, it's red brick, and must have once been plain but handsome. Now the gates have sentries, and there are ugly new floodlights mounted on metal posts above it and barbed wire along the bottom and broken glass set in concrete along the top. No one goes through those gates willingly. The precautions are for those trying to get out, though to make it even as far as the wall from the inside, past the electronic alarm system, would be next to impossible. Beside the main gateway, there are 6 more bodies hanging by the necks, their hands tied in front of them, their heads in white bags tipped sideways onto their shoulders. There must have been a men salvaging early this morning. I didn't hear the bells. Perhaps I've become used to them. We stop, together as if on signal, and stand and look at the bodies. It doesn't matter if we look. We're supposed to look. This is what they're there for, hanging on the wall. Sometimes they'll be there for days, until there's a new batch, so as many people as possible will have the chance to see them. What they are hanging from is hooks. The hooks have been set into the brickwork of the wall for this purpose. Not all of them are occupied. The hooks look like appliances for the armless, or steel question marks, upside down and sideways. It's the bags over the heads that are the worst, worse than the faces themselves would be. It makes the men look like dolls on which the faces have not yet been painted, like scarecrows, which, in a way, is what they are, since they are meant to scare. Or as if their heads are sacks, stuffed with some undifferentiated material like flour or dough. It's the obvious heaviness of the heads, their vacancy, the way gravity pulls them down and there's no life anymore to hold them up. The heads are zeros. Though if you look and look, as we are doing, you can see the outlines of the features under the white cloth, like gray shadows. The heads are the heads of snowmen, with the coal eyes and the carrot noses fallen out. The heads are melting. But on one bag there's blood, which is seeped through the white cloth where the mouth must have been. It makes another mouth, a small red one, like the mouths painted with thick brushes by kindergarten children. A child's idea of a smile. This smile of blood is what fixes the attention, finally. These are not snowmen, after all. The men wear white coats, like those worn by doctors or scientists. Doctors and scientists aren't the only ones. There are others, but they must have had a run on them this morning. Each has a placard hung around his neck to show why he has been executed. A drawing of a human fetus. They were doctors, then, in the time before when such things were legal. Angel makers, they used to call them. Or was that something else? They've been turned up now by the searches through hospital records, or more likely, since most hospitals destroyed such records once it became clear what was going to happen, by informants. Ex-nurses, perhaps, or a pair of them, since evidence from a single woman is no longer admissible. Or another doctor, hoping to save his own skin, or someone already accused, lashing out at an enemy, or at random, in some desperate bid for safety. Though informants are not always pardoned. These men, we've been told, are like war criminals. It's no excuse that what they did was legal at the time. Their crimes are retroactive. They have committed atrocities and must be made into examples for the rest. Though this is hardly needed. No woman in her right mind these days would seek to prevent a birth, should she be so lucky as to conceive. What we are supposed to feel towards these bodies is hatred and scorn. This isn't what I feel. These bodies hanging on the wall are time travelers, anachronisms. They've come here from the past. What I feel towards them is blankness. What I feel is that I must not feel. What I feel is partly relief, because none of these men is Luke. Luke wasn't a doctor. Isn't. I look at the one red smile. The red of the smile is the same as the red of the tulips in Serena Joy's garden, towards the base of the flowers where they are beginning to heal. The red is the same, but there is no connection. The tulips are not tulips of blood. The red smiles are not flowers. Neither thing makes a comment on the other. The tulip is not a reason for disbelief in the hanged man or vice versa. Each thing is valid and really there. It is through a field of such valid objects that I must pick my way every day and in every way. I put a lot of effort into making such distinctions. I need to make them. I need to be very clear in my own mind. I feel a tremor in the woman beside me. Is she crying? In what way could it make her look good? I can't afford to know. My own hands are clenched, I note, tight around the handle of my basket. I won't give anything away. Ordinary, said Aunt Lydia, is what you're used to. This may not seem ordinary to you now, but after a time it will. It will become ordinary. 3. Night. Chapter 7. The night is mine, my own time, to do with as I will, as long as I am quiet, as long as I don't move, as long as I lie still. The difference between lie and lay. Lay is always passive. Even men used to say, I'd like to get laid. Though sometimes they said, I'd like to lay her. All this is pure speculation. I don't really know what men used to say. I had only their words for it. I lie then, inside the room, under the plaster eye in the ceiling, behind the white curtains, between the sheets, neatly as they, and step sideways out of my own time. Out of time. Though this is time, nor am I out of it. But the night is my time out. Where should I go? Somewhere good. Moira, sitting on the edge of my bed, legs crossed, ankle on knee, in her purple overalls, one dangly earring, the gold fingernail she wore to be eccentric, a cigarette between her stubby, yellow-ended fingers. Let's go for a beer. You're getting ashes in my bed, I said. If you'd make it, you wouldn't have this problem, said Moira. In half an hour, I said. I had a paper due the next day. What was it? Psychology, English, economics. We studied things like that, then. On the floor of the room there were books, open face down, this way and that, extravagantly. Now, said Moira. You don't need to paint your face, it's only me. What's your paper on? I just did one on date rape. Date rape, I said. You're so trendy. It sounds like some kind of a dessert. Date rapé. Ha ha, said Moira. Get your coat. She got it herself and tossed it at me. I'm borrowing $5 off you, okay? Or in a park somewhere with my mother. How old was I? It was cold. Our breaths came out in front of us. There were no leaves on the trees. Gray sky, 2 ducks in the pond, disconsolate. Breadcrumbs under my fingers, in my pocket. That's it. She said we were going to feed the ducks. But there were some women burning books. That's what she was really there for, to see her friends. She'd lied to me. Saturdays were supposed to be my day. I turned away from her, sulking, towards the ducks. But the fire drew me back. There were some men, too, among the women, and the books were magazines. They must have poured gasoline because the flame shot high, and then they began dumping the magazines from boxes, not too many at a time. Some of them were chanting, onlookers gathered. Their faces were happy, ecstatic, almost. Fire can do that. Even my mother's face, usually pale, thinnish, looked ruddy and cheerful, like a Christmas card. And there was another woman, large, with a soot smear down her cheek and an orange knitted cap. I remember her. "You want to throw one on, honey?" she said. How old was I? "Good riddance to bad rubbish," she said, chuckling. "It okay?" she said to my mother. "If she wants to," my mother said. She had a way of talking about me to others as if I couldn't hear. The woman handed me one of the magazines. It had a pretty woman on it, with no clothes on, hanging from the ceiling by a chain wound around her hands. I looked at it with interest. It didn't frighten me. I thought she was swinging, like Tarzan from a vine on the TV. "Don't let her see it," said my mother. "Here," she said to me, "toss it in quick." I threw the magazine into the flames. It riffled open in the wind of its burning. Big flakes of paper came loose, sailed into the air, still on fire, parts of women's bodies turning to black ash in the air before my eyes. But then what happens? But then what happens? I know I lost time. There must have been needles, pills, something like that. I couldn't have lost that much time without help. "You've had a shock," they said. I would come up through a roaring and confusion like surf boiling. I can remember feeling quite calm. I can remember screaming. It felt like screaming, though it may have only been a whisper. "Where is she? What have you done with her?" There was no night or day, only a flickering. After a while, there were chairs again and a bed, and after that, a window. "She's in good hands," they said, "with people who are fit. You are unfit, but you want the best for her, don't you?" They showed me a picture of her, standing outside on a lawn. Her face closed oval. Her light hair was pulled back tight behind her head. Holding her hand was a woman I didn't know. She was only as tall as the woman's elbow. "You've killed her," I said. She looked like an angel, solemn, compact, made of air. She was wearing a dress I'd never seen, white and down to the ground. I would like to believe this is a story I'm telling. I need to believe it. I must believe it. Those who can believe that such stories are only stories have a better chance. If it's a story I'm telling, then I have control over the ending. Then there will be an ending to the story, and real life will come after it. I can pick up where I left off. It isn't a story I'm telling. It's also a story I'm telling in my head as I go along. Tell rather than write, because I have nothing to write with, and writing is in any case forbidden. But if it's a story, even in my head, I must be telling it to someone. You don't tell a story only to yourself. There's always someone else. Even when there is no one. A story is like a letter. "Dear you," I'll say. Just you, without a name. Attaching a name attaches you to the world of fact, which is riskier, more hazardous. Who knows what the chances are out there of survival, yours. I will say, "You. You." Like an old love song. "You" can mean more than one. "You" can mean thousands. "I'm not in any immediate danger," I'll say to you. I'll pretend you can hear me. But it's no good because I know you can't. 4. Waiting Room. Chapter 8. The good weather holds. It's almost like June, when we could get out our sundresses and our sandals and go for an ice cream cone. There are 3 new bodies on the wall. One is a priest, still wearing the black cassock. That's been put on him for the trial, even though they gave up wearing those years ago when the sect wars first began. Cassocks made them too conspicuous. The two others have purple placards hung around their necks. Gender treachery. Their bodies still wear the Guardian uniforms. Caught together they must have been, but where? A barracks? A shower? It's hard to say. The snowman with the red smile is gone. We should go back, I say to Uvglen. I'm always the one to say this. Sometimes I feel that if I didn't say it, she would stay here forever. But is she mourning or gloating? I still can't tell. Without a word, she swivels, as if she's voice-activated, as if she's on little oiled wheels, as if she's on top of a music box. I resent this grace of hers. I resent her meek head, bowed as if into a heavy wind. But there is no wind. We leave the wall, walk back the way we came, in the warm sun. It's a beautiful May day, Uvglen says. I feel rather than see her head turn towards me, waiting for a reply. Yes, I say. Praise be, I add as an afterthought. May Day used to be a distress signal a long time ago in one of those wars we studied in high school. I kept getting them mixed up, but you could tell them apart by the airplanes if you paid attention. It was Luke who told me about May Day, though. May Day, May Day, for pilots whose planes had been hit, and ships. Was it ships, too? At sea. Maybe it was SOS for ships. I wish I could look it up. And it was something from Beethoven, for the beginning of the victory in one of those wars. Do you know what it came from? Said Luke. May Day? No, I said. It's a strange word to use for that, isn't it? Newspapers and coffee on Sunday mornings, before she was born. There were still newspapers then. We used to read them in bed. It's French, he said. From M'aider. Help me. Coming towards us, there's a small procession, a funeral. Three women, each with a black transparent veil thrown over her headdress. An Ikano wife and two others, the mourners, also Ikano wives, her friends, perhaps. Their striped dresses are worn-looking, as are their faces. Someday, when times improve, says Aunt Lydia, no one will have to be an Ikano wife. The first one is the bereaved, the mother. She carries a small black jar. From the size of the jar, you can tell how old it was when it foundered inside her, flowed to its death. 2 or 3 months, too young to tell whether or not it was an unbaby. The older ones and those that die at birth have boxes. We pause out of respect while they go by. I wonder if Uvglen feels what I do, pain, like a stab in the belly. We put our hands over our hearts to show these stranger women that we feel with them in their loss. Beneath her veil, the first one scowls at us. One of the others turns aside, spits on the sidewalk. The Ikano wives do not like us. We go past the shops and come to the barrier again and are passed through. We continue on among the large, empty-looking houses, the weedless lawns. At the corner near the house where I'm posted, Uvglen stops, turns to me. Under his eye, she says, the right farewell. Under his eye, I reply, and she gives a little nod. She hesitates, as if to say something more, but then she turns away and walks down the street. I watch her. She's like my own reflection, in a mirror from which I am moving away. In the driveway, Nick is polishing the whirlwind again. He's reached the chrome at the back. I put my gloved hand on the latch of the gate, open it, push inward. The gate clicks behind me. The tulips along the border are redder than ever, opening, no longer wine cups but chalices thrusting themselves up. To what end? They are, after all, empty. When they are old, they turn themselves inside out, then explode slowly, the petals thrown out like shards. Nick looks up and begins to whistle. Then he says, Nice walk? I nod, but do not answer with my voice. He isn't supposed to speak to me. Of course some of them will try, said Aunt Lydia. All flesh is weak. All flesh is grass, I corrected her in my head. They can't help it, she said. God made them that way, but he did not make you that way. He made you different. It's up to you to set the boundaries. Later, you will be thanked. In the garden behind the house, the commander's wife is sitting, in the chair she's had brought out. Serena Joy. What a stupid name. It's like something you'd put on your hair in the other time, the time before, to straighten it. Serena Joy, it would say on the bottle, with a woman's head in cut paper silhouette on a pink oval background with scalloped gold edges. With everything to choose from in the way of names, why did she pick that one? Serena Joy was never her real name, not even then. Her real name was Pam. I read that in a profile on her, in a news magazine, long after I'd first watched her singing while my mother slept in on Sunday mornings. By that time, she was worthy of a profile. Time, or Newsweek it was, it must have been. She wasn't singing anymore by then. She was making speeches. She was good at it. Her speeches were about the sanctity of the home, about how women should stay home. Serena Joy didn't do this herself. She made speeches instead, but she presented this failure of hers as a sacrifice she was making for the good of all. Around that time, someone tried to shoot her and missed. Her secretary, who was standing right behind her, was killed instead. Someone else planted a bomb in her car, but it went off too early. Though some people said she'd put the bomb in her own car for sympathy. That's how hot things were getting. Luke and I would watch her sometimes in the late-night news. Bathrobes, nightcaps. We'd watch her sprayed hair and her hysteria, and the tears she could still produce at will, and the mascara blackening her cheeks. By that time she was wearing more makeup. We thought she was funny. Or Luke thought she was funny. I only pretended to think so. Really, she was a little frightening. She was in earnest. She doesn't make speeches anymore. She has become speechless. She stays in her home, but it doesn't seem to agree with her. How furious she must be, now that she's been taken at her word. She's looking at the tulips. Her cane is beside her on the grass. Her profile is towards me. I can see that in the quick sideways look I take at her as I go past. It wouldn't do to stare. It's no longer a flawless, cut-paper profile. Her face is sinking in upon itself, and I think of those towns built on underground rivers, where houses and whole streets disappear overnight into sudden quagmires or coal towns collapsing into the mines beneath them. Something like this must have happened to her when she saw the true shape of things to come. She doesn't turn her head. She doesn't acknowledge my presence in any way, although she knows I'm there. I can tell she knows. It's like a smell, her knowledge. Something gone sour, like old milk. It's not the husbands you have to watch out for, said Aunt Lydia. It's the wives. You should always try to imagine what they must be feeling. Of course they will resent you. It's only natural. Try to feel for them. Aunt Lydia thought she was very good at feeling for other people. Try to pity them. Forgive them, for they know not what they do. Again, the tremulous smile of a beggar, the weak-eyed blinking, the gaze upwards, through the round steel-rimmed glasses, towards the back of the classroom, as if the green-painted plaster ceiling were opening and God on a cloud of pink pearl face powder were coming down through the wires and sprinkler plumbing. You must realize that they are defeated women. They have been unable. Here her voice broke off, and there was a pause, during which I could hear a sigh, a collective sigh from those around me. It was a bad idea to rustle or fidget during these pauses. Aunt Lydia might look abstracted, but she was aware of every twitch. So there was only the sigh. The future is in your hands, she resumed. She held her own hands out to us, the ancient gesture that was both an offering and an invitation to come forward into an embrace and acceptance. In your hands, she said, looking down at her own hands, as if they had given her the idea. But there was nothing in them. They were empty. It was our hands that were supposed to be full, of the future, which could be held, but not seen. I walk around to the back door, open it, go in, set my basket down on the kitchen table. The table has been scrubbed off, cleared of flour. Today's bread, freshly baked, is cooling on its rack. The kitchen smells of yeast, a nostalgic smell. It reminds me of other kitchens, kitchens that were mine. It smells of mothers, although my own mother did not make bread. It smells of me, in former times, when I was a mother. This is a treacherous smell, and I know I must shut it out. Rita is there, sitting at the table, peeling and slicing carrots. Old carrots they are, thick ones, overwintered, bearded from their time in storage. The new carrots, tender and pale, won't be ready for weeks. The knife she uses is sharp and bright and tempting. I would like to have a knife like that. Rita stops chopping the carrots, stands up, takes the parcels out of the basket, almost eagerly. She looks forward to seeing what I've brought, although she always frowns while opening the parcels. Nothing I bring fully pleases her. She's thinking she could have done better herself. She would rather do the shopping, get exactly what she wants. She envies me the walk. In this house, we all envy each other something. They've got oranges, I say, at Milk and Honey. There are still some left. I hold out this idea to her like an offering. I wish to ingratiate myself. I saw the oranges yesterday, but I didn't tell Rita. Yesterday, she was too grumpy. I could get some tomorrow, if you'd give me the tokens for them. I hold out the chicken to her. She wanted steak today, but there wasn't any. Rita grunts, not revealing pleasure or acceptance. She'll think about it, the grunt says, in her own sweet time. She undoes the string on the chicken and the glazed paper. She prods the chicken, flexes a wing, pokes a finger into the cavity, fishes out the giblets. The chicken lies there, headless and without feet, goose-pimpled, as though shivering. Bath day, Rita says, without looking at me. Cora comes into the kitchen from the pantry at the back where they keep the mops and brooms. A chicken, she says, almost with delight. Scrawny, says Rita. But it'll have to do. There wasn't much else, I say. Rita ignores me. Looks big enough to me, says Cora. Is she standing up for me? I look at her to see if I should smile, but no, it's only the food she's thinking of. She's younger than Rita. The sunlight, coming slant now through the west window, catches her hair, parted and drawn back. She must have been pretty, quite recently. There's a little mark, like a dimple, in each of her ears, where the punctures for earrings have grown over. Tall, says Rita, but bony. You should speak up, she says to me, looking directly at me for the first time. Ain't like you're common. She means the commander's rank, but in the other sense, her sense, she thinks I am common. She's over 60. Her mind's made up. She goes to the sink, runs her hands briefly under the tap, dries them on the dish towel. The dish towel is white with blue stripes. Dish towels are the same as they always were. Sometimes these flashes of normality come at me from the side like ambushes. The ordinary, the usual, a reminder like a kick. I see the dish towel out of context and I catch my breath. For some, in some ways, things haven't changed that much. Who's doing the bath? Says Rita to Cora, not to me. I gotta tenderize this bird. I'll do it later, says Cora, after the dusting. Just so it gets done, says Rita. They're talking about me as though I can't hear. To them, I'm a household chore, one among many. I've been dismissed. I pick up the basket, go through the kitchen door and along the hall towards the grandfather clock. The sitting room door is closed. Sun comes through the fanlight, falling in colors across the floor, red and blue, purple. I step into it briefly, stretch out my hands, They fill with flowers of light. I go up the stairs, my face distant and white and distorted, framed in the hall mirror which bulges outward like an eye under pressure. I follow the dusty pink runner down the long upstairs hallway, back to the room. There's someone standing in the hall, near the door to the room where I stay. The hall is dusky. This is a man, his back to me. He's looking into the room, dark against its light. I can see now. It's the commander. He isn't supposed to be here. He hears me coming, turns, hesitates, walks forward, towards me. He is violating custom. What do I do now? I stop. He pauses. I can't see his face. He's looking at me. What does he want? But then he moves forward again, steps to the side to avoid touching me, inclines his head, is gone. Something has been shown to me, but what is it? Like the flag of an unknown country seen for an instant above a curve of hill. It could mean attack. It could mean parley. It could mean the edge of something, a territory. The signals animals give one another, lowered blue eyelids, ears laid back, raised hackles, a flash of bared teeth. What in hell does he think he's doing? Nobody else has seen him, I hope. Was he invading? Was he in my room? I called it mine. Chapter 9. My room, then. There has to be some space, finally, that I claim as mine, even in this time. I'm waiting in my room, which right now is a waiting room. When I go to bed, it's a bedroom. The curtains are still wavering in the small wind. The sun outside is still shining, though not in through the window directly. It has moved west. I'm trying not to tell stories, or at any rate, not this one. Someone has lived in this room before me. Someone like me, or I prefer to believe so. I discovered it 3 days after I was moved here. I had a lot of time to pass. I decided to explore the room. Not hastily, as one would explore a hotel room, expecting no surprise, opening and shutting the desk drawers, the cupboard doors, unwrapping the tiny, individually wrapped bar of soap, prodding the pillows. Will I ever be in a hotel room again? How I wasted them, those rooms, that freedom from being seen. Rented license. In the afternoons, when Luke was still in flight from his wife, when I was still imaginary for him, before we were married and I solidified, I would always get there first. Check in. It wasn't that many times, but it seems now like a decade, an era. I can remember what I wore. Each blouse, each scarf. I would pace, waiting for him. Turn the television on and then off. Dab behind my ears with perfume. Opium, it was. It was in a Chinese bottle, red and gold. I was nervous. How was I to know he loved me? It might be just an affair. Why did we ever say just? Though at that time, men and women tried each other on casually like suits, rejecting whatever did not fit. The knock would come at the door. I'd open, with relief, desire. He was so momentary, so condensed, and yet there seemed no end to him. We would lie in those afternoon beds afterwards, hands on each other, talking it over. Possible, impossible. What could be done? We thought we had such problems. How were we to know we were happy? But now it's the rooms themselves I miss as well. Even the dreadful paintings that hung on the walls. Landscapes with fall foliage or snow melting in hardwoods. Or women in period costume with China doll faces and bustles and parasols. Or sad-eyed clowns. Or bowls of fruit, stiff and chalky-looking. The fresh towels ready for spoilage. The waste baskets gaping their invitations, beckoning in the careless junk. Careless. I was careless in those rooms. I could lift the telephone and food would appear on a tray. Food I had chosen. Food that was bad for me, no doubt, and drink, too. There were Bibles in the dresser drawers, put there by some charitable society, though probably no one read them very much. There were postcards, too, with pictures of the hotel on them, and you could write on the postcards and send them to anyone you wanted. It seems like such an impossible thing now, like something you'd make up. So, I explored this room, not hastily then, like a hotel room, wasting it. I didn't want to do it all at once. I wanted to make it last. I divided the room into sections in my head. I allowed myself one section a day. This one section I would examine with the greatest minuteness. The unevenness of the plaster under the wallpaper. The scratches in the paint of the baseboard and the windowsill. Under the top coat of paint, the stains on the mattress. For I went so far as to lift the blankets and sheets from the bed, fold them back a little at a time, so they could be replaced quickly if anyone came. The stains on the mattress. Like dried flower petals. Not recent. Old love. There's no other kind of love in this room now. When I saw that, the evidence left by two people, of love or something like it, desire at least touch, between two people, now perhaps old or dead, I covered the bed again and lay down on it. I looked up at the blind plaster eye in the ceiling. I wanted to feel Luke lying beside me. I have them, these attacks of the past. Like faintness, a wave sweeping over my head. Sometimes it can hardly be borne. What is to be done? What is to be done? I thought. There is nothing to be done. They also serve who only stand and wait, or lie down and wait. I know why the glass in the window is shatterproof, and why they took down the chandelier. I wanted to feel Luke lying beside me, but there wasn't room. I saved the cupboard until the third day. I looked carefully over the door first, inside and out, then the walls with their brass hooks. How could they have overlooked the hooks? Why didn't they remove them? Too close to the floor? But still, a stocking, that's all you need. And the rod with the plastic hangers, my dresses hanging on them, the red woolen cape for cold weather, the shawl. I knelt to examine the floor, and there it was, in tiny writing. Quite fresh, it seemed. Scratched with a pin, or maybe just a fingernail, in the corner where the darkest shadow fell. Nolite te bastardes, cabrandorum. I didn't know what it meant, or even what language it was in. I thought it might be Latin, but I didn't know any Latin. Still, it was a message, and it was in writing, forbidden by that very fact, and it hadn't yet been discovered. Except by me, for whom it was intended. It was intended for whoever came next. It pleases me to ponder this message. It pleases me to think I'm communing with her, this unknown woman. For she is unknown, or if known, she has never been mentioned to me. It pleases me to know that her taboo message made it through, to at least one other person, washed itself up on the wall of my cupboard, was opened and read by me. Sometimes I repeat the words to myself. They give me a small joy. When I imagine the woman who wrote them, I think of her as about my age, maybe a little younger. I turn her into Moira. Moira, as she was when she was in college, in the room next to mine. Quirky, jaunty, athletic, with a bicycle once and a knapsack for hiking. Freckles, I think. Irreverent, resourceful. I wonder who she was, or is, and what's become of her. I tried that out on Rita the day I found the message. "Who's the woman who stayed in that room?" I said, before me. If I'd asked it differently, if I'd said, "Was there a woman who stayed in that room before me?" I might not have got anywhere. "Which one?" she said. She sounded grudging, suspicious, but then she almost always sounds like that when she speaks to me. "So there have been more than one," Some haven't stayed their full term of posting, their full 2 years. Some have been sent away for one reason or another. Or maybe not sent, gone? The lively one, I was guessing. The one with freckles.
You know her? Rita asked, more suspicious than ever.
I knew her before, I lied. I heard she was here. Rita accepted this. She knows there must be a grapevine, an underground of sorts.
She didn't work out, she said.
In what way? I asked, trying to sound as neutral as possible. But Rita clamped her lips together. I'm like a child here. There are some things I must not be told. What you don't know won't hurt you, was all she would say. Chapter 10. Sometimes I sing to myself in my head, something lugubrious, mournful, Presbyterian. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound, could save a wretch like me, who once was lost, but now am found, was bound, but now am free. I don't know if the words are right, I can't remember. Such songs are not sung anymore in public, especially the ones that use words like free. They are considered too dangerous. They belong to outlawed sects. I feel so lonely, baby. I feel so lonely, baby. I feel so lonely I could die. This, too, is outlawed. I know it from an old cassette tape of my mother's. She had a scratchy and untrustworthy machine, too, that could still play such things. She used to put the tape on when her friends came over and they'd had a few drinks. I don't sing like this often. It makes my throat hurt. There isn't much music in this house, except what we hear on the TV. Sometimes Rita will hum while kneading or peeling, a wordless humming, tuneless, unfathomable. And sometimes from the front sitting room there will be the thin sound of Serena's voice from a disc made long ago and played now with the volume low, so she won't be caught listening as she sits in there knitting, remembering her own former and now amputated glory. Hallelujah. It's warm for the time of year. Houses like this heat up in the sun. There's not enough insulation. Around me, the air is stagnant, despite the little current, the breath coming in past the curtains. I'd like to be able to open the window as wide as it could go. Soon we'll be allowed to change into the summer dresses. The summer dresses are unpacked and hanging in the closet, two of them, pure cotton, which is better than the synthetics like the cheaper ones, though even so, when it's muggy in July and August, you sweat inside them. No worry about sunburn, though, said Aunt Lydia. The spectacles women used to make of themselves, oiling themselves like roast meat on a spit, and bare backs and shoulders on the street in public, and legs, not even stockings on them. No wonder those things used to happen. Things. The word she used when whatever it stood for was too distasteful or filthy or horrible to pass her lips. A successful life for her was one that avoided things, excluded things. Such things do not happen to nice women. And not good for the complexion, not at all. Wrinkle you up like a dried apple. But we weren't supposed to care about our complexions anymore. She'd forgotten that. In the park, said Aunt Lydia. Lying on blankets, men and women together sometimes, and at that, she began to cry, standing up there in front of us, in full view. I'm doing my best, she said. I'm trying to give you the best chance you can have. She blinked. The light was too strong for her. Her mouth trembled, around her front teeth, teeth that stuck out a little and were long and yellowish. And I thought about the dead mice we would find on the doorstep when we lived in the house, all three of us, four, counting our cat, who was the one making these offerings. Aunt Lydia pressed her hand over her mouth of a dead rodent. After a minute, she took her hand away. I wanted to cry, too, because she reminded me. If only she wouldn't eat half of them first, I said to Luke.
Don't think it's easy for me either, said Aunt Lydia.
Moira,
breezing into my room, dropping her denim jacket on the floor. "Got any cigs?" she said. "In my purse," I said. "No matches, though." Moira rummages in my purse. "You should throw out some of this junk," she says. "I'm giving an underwhore party." "A what?" I say. There's no point trying to work. Moira won't allow it. She's like a cat that crawls onto the page when you're trying to read. "You know, like Tupperware, only with underwear. Tart stuff. Lace crotches, snap garters, bras that push your tits up." She finds my lighter, lights the cigarette she's extracted from my purse. "Want one?" Tosses the package, with great generosity, considering they're mine. "Thanks, Piles," I say sourly. "You're crazy. Where'd you get an idea like that?" "Working my way through college," says Moira. "I've got connections. Friends of my mother's. It's big in the suburbs. Once they start getting age spots, they figure they've got to beat the competition. The porno marts and what have you." I'm laughing. She always made me laugh. "But here," I say, "who will come? Who needs it?" "You're never too young to learn," she says. "Come on, it'll be great. We'll all pee in our pants laughing." Is that how we lived then? But we lived as usual. Everyone does, most of the time. Whatever is going on is as usual. Even this is as usual now. We lived as usual by ignoring. Ignoring isn't the same as ignorance. You have to work at it. Nothing changes instantaneously. In a gradually heating bathtub, you'd be boiled to death before you knew it. There were stories in the newspapers, of course. Corpses in ditches or the woods, bludgeoned to death or mutilated, interfered with, as they used to say. But they were about other women, and the men who did such things were other men. None of them were the men we knew. The newspaper stories were like dreams to us. Bad dreams dreamt by others. How awful, we would say. And they were, but they were awful without being believable. They were too melodramatic. They had a dimension that was not the dimension of our lives. We were the people who were not in the papers. We lived in the blank white spaces at the edges of print. It gave us more freedom. We lived in the gaps between the stories. From below, from the driveway, comes the sound of the car being started. It's quiet in this area. There isn't a lot of traffic. You can hear things like that very clearly. Car motors, lawn mowers, the clipping of a hedge, the slam of a door. You could hear a shout clearly, or a shot, if such noises were ever made here. Sometimes there are distant sirens. I go to the window and sit on the window seat, which is too narrow for comfort. There's a hard little cushion on it, with a petit-point cover, Faith, in square print, surrounded by a wreath of lilies. Faith is a faded blue, the leaves of the lilies a dingy green. This is a cushion once used elsewhere, worn but not enough to throw out. Somehow it's been overlooked. I can spend minutes, tens of minutes, running my eyes over the print. Faith. It's the only thing they've given me to read. If I were caught doing it, would it count? I didn't put the cushion here myself. The motor turns, and I lean forward, pulling the white curtain across my face like a veil. It's semi-sheer. I can see through it. If I press my forehead against the glass and look down, I can see the back half of the whirlwind. Nobody is there, but as I watch, I see Nick come round to the back door of the car, open it, stand stiffly beside it. His cap is straight now, and his sleeves rolled down and buttoned. I can't see his face because I'm looking down on him. Now the commander is coming out. I glimpse him only for an instant, foreshortened, walking to the car. He doesn't have his hat on, so it's not a formal event he's going to. His hair is gray. Silver, you might call it, if you were being kind. I don't feel like being kind. The one before this was bald, so I suppose he's an improvement. If I could spit out the window or throw something, the cushion, for instance, I might be able to hit him. Moira and I with paper bags filled with water. Water bombs, they were called. Leaning out my dorm window, dropping them on the heads of the boys below. It was Moira's idea. What were they trying to do? Climb a ladder for something. For our underwear. That dormitory had once been co-educational. There were still urinals in one of the washrooms on our floor. But by the time I'd got there, they'd put things back the way they were. The commander stoops, gets into the car, disappears, and Nick shuts the door. A moment later, the car moves backward, down the driveway and onto the street, and vanishes behind the hedge. I ought to feel hatred for this man. I know I ought to feel it, but it isn't what I do feel. What I feel is more complicated than that. I don't know what to call it. It isn't love. Chapter 11. Yesterday morning I went to the doctor. Was taken by a guardian, one of those with red armbands who are in charge of such things. We rode in a red car, him in the front, me in the back. No twin went with me. On these occasions, I'm solitaire. I'm taken to the doctor's once a month for tests. Urine, hormones, cancer smear, blood test. The same as before, except that now it's obligatory. The doctor's office is in a modern office building. We ride up in the elevator silently, the guardian facing me. In the black mirror wall of the elevator, I can see the back of his head. At the office itself, I go in. He waits, outside in the hall, with the other guardians, on one of the chairs placed there for that purpose. Inside the waiting room, there are other women, three of them, in red. This doctor is a specialist. Covertly, we regard each other, sizing up each other's bellies. Is anyone lucky? The nurse records our names and the numbers from our passes on the CompuDoc to see if we are who we are supposed to be. He's 6 feet tall, about 40, a diagonal scar across his cheek. He sits typing, his hands too big for the keyboard, still wearing his pistol in the shoulder holster. When I'm called, I go through the doorway into the inner room. It's white, featureless like the outer one, except for a folding screen, red cloth stretched on a frame, a gold eye painted on it, with a snake-twined sword upright beneath it, like a sort of handle. The snakes and the sword are bits of broken symbolism left over from the time before. After I've filled the small bottle left ready for me in a little washroom, I take off my clothes behind the screen and leave them folded on the chair. When I'm naked, I lie down on the examining table, on the sheet of chilly, crackling, disposable paper. I pull the second sheet, the cloth one, up over my body. At neck level, there's another sheet, suspended from the ceiling. It intersects me so that the doctor will never see my face. He deals with a torso only. When I'm arranged, I reach my hand out, fumble for the small lever at the right side of the table, pull it back. Somewhere else a bell rings, unheard by me. After a minute, the door opens. Footsteps come in. There is breathing. He isn't supposed to speak to me except when it's absolutely necessary. But this doctor is talkative. "How are we getting along?" he says, some tick of speech from the other time. The sheet is lifted from my skin. A draft pimples me. A cold finger, rubber-clad and jellied, slides into me. I am poked and prodded. The finger retreats, enters otherwise, withdraws. "Nothing wrong with you," the doctor says, as if to himself. "Any pain, honey?" He calls me honey. "No," I say. My breasts are fingered in their turn, a search for ripeness, rot. The breathing comes nearer. I smell old smoke, aftershave, tobacco, dust on hair. Then the voice, very soft, close to my head. That's him, bulging the sheet. "I could help you," he says, whispers. "What?" I say. "Shh," he says. "I could help you. I've helped others." "Help me?" I say, my voice as low as his. "How? Does he know something? Has he seen Luke? Has he found? Can he bring back?" "How do you think?" he says, still barely breathing it. Is that his hand sliding up my leg? He's taken off the glove. The door's locked. No one will come in. They'll never know it isn't his. He lifts the sheet. The lower part